It was a desire to plant something that we would want to attend, but it was also a kind of recognition of a gaping hole in the city. And I at the time was just starting to develop a bit of a philosophy or a theology of city. Now I feel like I've given myself lots of time to that, but at the time I just thought Atlanta mattered.
Hey everyone, I'm Bishop Jeff Bailey. Welcome to the C4SO podcast.
Chris, it's so good to have you here on the podcast.
Super fun. I'm honored to share some space with you, brother.
So let's just dive in here together.
Yeah.
You are in the rare position of a rector who has been part of a church from the very beginning all the way through multiple stages of growth. You started Trinity how many years ago?
24, October of 2002.
Coming up on 25 years. So that's an unusual position to be able to think through. What does growth look like? So often people get churches started, then they at some point hand them on to somebody else, or they come in where a church has been started and then taking it from one stage to another. I just want to talk about some of those stages, thinking about what growth looks like and how we be thoughtful and strategic about those kinds of things. So cast your mind back to the very earliest days of Trinity. What do you look back on and notice about those years?
Well, you may have to pay for some counseling, you know, some of the PTSD. I mean, you know, 24 years ago, I was a 26-year-old at the time. Myself a 26-year-old wise, energetic man. Now I look back and I have some questions about that. But what we weren't short on was a love for Jesus, a passion for Atlanta. I pastor in the city center of Atlanta, Georgia, and we knew that we wanted to plant a church. That was about it. And so the project of the first probably 6 or 7 years was pretty exciting and chaotic, and all jokes aside, at times somewhat traumatic. I mean, we were kind of in a fire ready aim posture versus a ready aim fire. We just planted. We just said, let's love Jesus in Atlanta and let's do it together. So we've learned a lot of lessons. I mean, there are a lot of things that I think, well, there are a lot of things I know I do differently now, but I'm not sure that you can skip past some of those early days around zeal, passion, where it's all consuming. I'm glad I'm not there now, but boy, I think there's a benefit to some of that passion that comes when you're starting something.
What was the driving thing that said, we've got to do this? I've heard sometimes church planners say, I was just trying to create a church that I felt like I could go to and that I wanted to bring my friends to. What was the zeal for? What were you trying to do?
It was that, what you just said, but it was also a recognition that I was serving at the time in a church that was out in the suburbs, and I increasingly felt the grief of looking in the city center and not seeing lots of churches that were reaching the kind of people that we felt well equipped to reach. And so it was a desire to plant something that we would want to attend, but it was also a kind of recognition of a gaping hole in the city. And I at the time was just starting to develop a bit of a philosophy or a theology of city. Now I feel like I've given myself lots of time to that. But at the time I just thought Atlanta matters. I was born in Atlanta. It's my home. And I thought we need churches in the city that are not going to run away from the city. And so we were moving into, I think, a place of feeling a sense of calling for a place, not just a church we wanted to go to, but that plus a sense of vocational calling to location.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you were to look back and say from this perspective, these are a couple things we really did right. I would recommend it to others who are just getting started planting. And these are a couple things we did wrong. If you're giving advice to a church planter rooted in those lessons from those early years, what would you highlight?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jeff. I mean, the main thing we did right was we did it as a team. It wasn't a Lone Ranger situation. I was catalytic in casting vision, but I wouldn't have gone if it had not been for a group of committed colleagues, friends, people that also loved Atlanta. We loved one another. And so we planted together. We planted as a team. And I would say that was the best decision that we made. The second decision that I think was really important was we decided immediately that we were going to adopt a long-term view of what missional engagement would look like. I had seen at the time, and I'm sure you're well aware, it's like churches come and go kind of like coffee shops. You know, they show up, things don't happen like they want them to happen, and then they leave. And so we made a decision that we were going to engage in a form of a long obedience in the same direction. Now, we did not know what that meant exactly. I think for us, it probably meant we're gonna go all in on this as a team for at least 5 years and see what God's going to do here. And those decisions, I think, really rooted us and anchored us. We also, I think, knew what we didn't know. And by that, I mean this. I think it takes a long time to really exegete a particular place to understand an area. I think we can come in with a kind of casual or superficial understanding of what a neighborhood needs or a city needs. And we had this, I think, healthy suspicion about we think we know some stuff, but there's a lot we don't know. So we adopted a posture of humility, which I think is connected to that long obedience thing. We thought it's going to take us a long time to really even know what we're doing and what our community needs from us. So those would be a few things that I think we did right.
Yeah.
On the side of what we didn't do right, I mean, I think we could, I probably one day will write a book about that because there were so many things. Zeal, we had a lot of. Part of the downside was that I think I allowed Trinity and church planting to become all-encompassing. Mm-hmm. And it's easy when we use language around the mission of God, a calling. It's easy then to justify that becoming an all-encompassing thing. So when I look back, I think in my youth and in my zeal and in my passion, there was also a little bit of like unexamined narcissism in there of thinking I was going to change Atlanta with my buddies for Jesus. And I think there was not enough separation between me as a human, a child, image bearing child of God, and the work that he had called us to do. They blended too much in the early days. And it took some work. I mean, Eugene Peterson was instrumental to me. I remember first being handed his books on pastoral ministry a couple of years into the life of the church. And it was kind of the first corrective. I thought, oh, I think I've got no boundaries here and I need to begin to have them. And, you know, as a result, we were raising our children. Our kids were literally, one of them had been born prior to the plant. The other two came in the early years of planting. And, you know, our family, we paid a price because we were in it up to our necks all the time. So that's one of the big mistakes. I think the other mistake, and this probably dovetails some into what we're going to talk about in a few minutes, we weren't prepared for church growth. We were afraid of it even, maybe a bit ambivalent around growth because we had an idea of how things were going to go. And when the church started to grow and all of these kids started coming to know Jesus, we were overwhelmed by growth because we were a little allergic to structure. And then God was bringing all this increase and it created a bit of an imbalance around it. At certain points, it felt like, you know, like a bicycle going down a hill and it's super exciting. And then things start to get a little shaky and you're like, oh my gosh. We might be going too fast. This may be going quicker than we thought. At times, I think maybe another metaphor, we felt like we had caught a tiger by the tail. And, you know, a church not growing has its own problems, but one that's growing super fast, it has another set of problems and they're pretty chaotic.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about that a little bit because I do think that those questions of growth, they're with us all the time. You know, this is true for all of our churches in C4SO, they're at different stages of growth and you get to one level and, you know, it sometimes feels like the systems that got us to that level are now holding us back.
100%.
Tim Keller has a great article that he wrote years ago that people still consult because it's an evergreen set of concepts in terms of what it looks like to be a church at one stage and what that means when you move to the next stage and the challenges of getting from one to the other. It's sometimes helpful just to hear those narratives in terms of what that progression was like for you. And again, some of the key lessons that were learned along the way.
Yeah, that's a great question. And if you had not mentioned his article, that process management church growth piece that Keller wrote probably 30 years ago, was instrumental for us, and it still is. I use it to coach church planters even now. So I would say two things about growth and size. Number one, I think it's important for us not to moralize church size. Some churches are meant, I think, by God to be smaller, and others are meant to be larger. In the same way that some trees grow bigger and some grow larger. One of the lies I think that we tend to fall into in the United States and in the West is that bigger is always better. And so we think if something is not big, it's probably something's wrong with it. And one of the analogies that we used early on for ourselves, and I now use this with my church planters, is that let's take a dog, for instance. If you are a St. Bernard and you want to be a Cocker Spaniel, and so you starve yourself, you're just going to be a big, unhealthy dog. And conversely, if you're a Cocker Spaniel and you wish that you could be a St. Bernard, you're just going to be an unhealthy little dog if you overfeed that animal. And so one of the things that I think churches have to learn how to do in using circumstance and collective discernment and time is to discern what kind of dog you're meant to be. And you could use tree metaphors if that's a cleaner one for you. But I think there is a discernment that you have to come to some conclusions over time. And usually 5 to 7 years, you've got a pretty good sense of like, are we a 100-member church? Is this potentially a 300-member church? Or could this be a bigger church? Now, I think when a church is meant to be bigger, it's not just so that it can be big. It's so that it would be a resource to the community and a kingdom catalytic agent in its city or its area. That's what happened to us. We grew numerically really despite ourselves. We didn't want to be a big church. But when we began to run into growth and then some of the frustration or the pinch points, and Keller puts his finger on this, I think, really helpfully, we knew that some of the systems that got us to this point would not serve us well if we were trying to obey what the Lord was giving in terms of where he was taking us. And a lot of that was around clearer roles. Mm-hmm. For our teammates, paid and non-paid. It was around communication strategy, repetitive communication. It was around the development of groups and diffused power sets. I think one of the biggest barriers to church growth, even just your good old-fashioned like getting to viability, is rectors and pastors want everything or need everything to run through them. There comes a point where that just doesn't work. And we began to confront those things at about 80 people. Once you get to about 80 people, you have to start thinking about things in a very different way than what got you to that 80 in terms of the early gathering. So yeah. A lot of lessons learned there, a lot of things, you know, because we started in a living room and now, you know, we have a facility, a church space. And so we've been through all those iterations over the years. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Say a little bit in terms of like things that, you know, churches have to lean in, and there's core things that they have to do better at.
Yeah, I think organizationally in roles, which is an area that I find in nonprofits in general, but definitely churches, this is not an area of strength typically in churches, is clarity around role and organizational structure. What I have learned is that when you are planting a church, everyone is a generalist. When I planted Trinity, I was preaching, I was mopping the floors, I was painting the walls. We were doing it all together. As you grow, and when you get to about 80 to 100 people, some of those roles start to specify, and it takes courage and it takes discernment to specify roles. It also means that some people who fit your organization or your church plant really early on will not fit in the future, which is really hard. It's better when that's mutually discerned, but sometimes it's not, and it gets really tricky. And I think it's actually an area where we lack courage and conviction, and we sometimes just miss some of the stewardship around where God would have us go and how he would have us grow. Think of growth. What I'm thinking of is kind of growth to the optimal space of calling and influence, not infinite growth. It's kind of back to that animal metaphor or the tree metaphor. But for us, if I remember moving more to a specialist role for myself and then helping my teammates do the same thing. And that was really painful at first, because mainly you're worried that you're not going to be good enough at whatever it is you're called to specialize in.
Right.
Boy, it makes all the difference, because then people are starting to like hit on multiple cylinders as the church grows and you become more of a healthy organization.
Yeah.
Connected to that, I think communication is a similar track. Rather than everything being extemporaneous, organic, we had to begin to systematize communication. We had to be repetitive about it. We had to start using social media and web. We had to recognize that people don't really hear a thing until you've told them multiple times. And so systemizing communication, I think, is probably less hard, less difficult for people now because we're in a more digital technological age. But for us back in the day, it required a pretty intentional shift in our strategy. You can't just mention something. You've got to say it over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah. And say a little bit about where you're trying to bring in other people. And I assume by that, you mean not just staff, but also how do you raise up lay leaders?
Oh my gosh. We have prioritized lay leadership at our church because we recognize very quickly if you are dependent upon one rector or a small team of people on a staff to do everything in the life of the church, it's a fool's errand. And so for us, we began to do just lots of language in our plant very early on about the part of priesthood of all believers that I think we all are on board with, which is that we're not all priests in the same way. I mean, Episcopal, holy orders, but we do all have some sort of leadership and shepherding potential. And we recognize that for many of our lay people in our church, their leadership opportunities at Trinity are the most valuable hour of their week that they spend. Like they may not love their jobs or they may think of their jobs as just something they do, but when they get to come and lead in ways that are meaningful, it is life-changing for them. And so we have built a diffuse power set at our church in that regard since day one. And it's been a place where, now we have to recruit and volunteers to what feel to me almost like an absurd number of people are volunteers and leaders in our church. But it's because we tell them that they really matter. At Trinity now, we have what we call teams. The language we use around meaningful involvement in our church is join a group, join a team. And teams are everything from our alpha team to our worship teams to our kids and youth people to people who brew coffee to people who work as lay caregivers. And by putting people together so they find community in a volunteer team situation, it's created a culture around volunteerism and teams in our church. Like we spend a month every year recruiting for teams. And it's really fun for me because I get to wear sports jerseys every Sunday for that month because we say like, get on a team, and we just turn it into a party. And our people have really bought into that. And I don't think they would have at this point, like if we had waited, but from the very beginning, we were like, we can't do this unless we're doing it all together.
Let me just go back to something you touched on, which is just thinking philosophically about growth or how we talk about church growth. Figuring out how to talk about it in ways that are helpful and healthy.
Yeah.
You know, I came of age in the church growth era where everyone was going to Saddleback conferences and reading business leadership books, the pastor, CEO. Then there was a sort of pendulum swing for understandable reasons against that. And we're all reading Eugene Peterson, and
that was my era.
And suspicious of any kind of conversations about church growth.
Yes.
I think your analogy about like what kind of dog are you supposed to be? What kind of tree are you supposed to be? I often say to folks and to our pastors, trying to discern what is God calling us to be? What are we called to lean into? And then what's the right size for that? What kind of resources do we need to be able to carry out that vision? Churches go through seasons where you feel called to one thing and you're just in a hard season. And it's not happening in the way that you thought it was going to or as fast as you thought it was going to. So I wonder, how do we create a culture in which there's healthy, honest, helpful, practical, life-giving conversations about church growth that avoid some of the mistakes that maybe we've made in the past?
Yeah. I think you're putting your finger on some really important questions. And as I think about us as a diocese, I think this is really important because the truth is, I think every church should be viable. Now, viability can be defined in different ways. And yet one way is it healthy? And is it a place where shalom is happening? Like, does it feel like it's working? And you can be an 80 member community and that really be working. I think you could even be smaller than that. That being said, my prayer for us in C4SO is that we would aim to kind of follow what an old vineyard guy used to call the pretty good church model. I remember Rich Nathan up in Columbus said, you know, I think we need more pretty good churches. And by that, he meant like two to 500 people, where you're big enough to have energy, but you're small enough to be nimble and adaptable. I think there's something really beautiful about looking to steward health in that direction. And if you don't get there, then God may have something a little bit different from you for you, but you'll be positioning yourself to be the best version of yourself that you can possibly be. In my coaching and mentoring of church planters and church leaders, one thing that I see a lot of is that sometimes there's just some really low-hanging fruit that could be cultivated. And if it were, it would move churches into some more vibrant space. And I don't think that's a church growth strategy. I think that's a church health strategy that might end up growing a church a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because why not remove the obstacles that maybe we're holding if we could? Because then we get to just be the best version of ourselves. And so one of the things that I tend to use when I'm talking to planters is like, let's try to figure out what you being the best version of yourself looks like. It may not look like, we should not aspire to have mega churches on every corner in the Anglican world or in any world.
Right.
But we should probably aspire to have vibrant, healthy, flourishing churches of varying sizes.
Yes,
and I think that we could probably do some work to get more of our churches in that direction. But you know what it takes? It takes senior leaders being willing to look in a little bit and examine blind spots and admit that we don't all know everything that we need to know.
Yeah. Yeah. So good. Are there some obvious candidates that you see frequently when you're working with churches of varying sizes?
Yeah. The biggest one that I see is pastor as everyone, everything, every man. Like the pastor has to be the leader of everything. They feel responsible. I think sometimes a misreading of Peterson reinforces some of this ideology where we believe that, you know, as a pastor, we're supposed to be intimately involved and aware of every part of every person in our community. And I just want to say, if you've got more than 10 people hanging around with you, you're actually probably not doing that to the degree that you think you are. And so one of the biggest, I think, pieces of low-hanging fruit is to begin to open up our hands and to begin to let go of control. I think for all of us in the helping professions, and pastors are certainly counted among that number, the shadow to that calling sometimes is a desire to control by helping. And so one of the biggest pieces of advice I give people is let's look at like what you could begin to let go of and who around you could begin to and might step up and emerge if you were to release some power in this space. Because what that does oftentimes is it causes the water level to rise and then all the boats rise with it. When people are using their gifts, everything's better. If one person is doing everything, that is not usually a recipe for goodness in a church plant or a nuclear family. I mean, right? That scales.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Thinking about where Trinity is at today. So you've gone through these various seasons. And one of the challenges, I think, for any vibrant organization is how do we maintain our vitality, our culture, those core values and sense of identity that we have to maintain.
Yeah.
To fulfill what God's calling us to, and that doesn't change from the very beginning to what we're doing today. How has that evolved, and what does it look like today to build into and to maintain and to champion a particular kind of culture at Trinity?
It is my main job. What you just said is that is my job. Mm-hmm. I think there are very few things that a rector can do that no one else can do. That is one of the things that senior leaders must do. At Trinity, we call them core commitments. We have 5 of them, and I talk about them ad nauseum. It is what I measure everything, all of our staff, our programming, our strategic planning process, everything runs through the core commitments, and it is my job. We joke around Trinity, the fastest way to starve a horse is to ask everyone to feed it. Someone's got to be tasked to feed the horse, and when it comes to culture, vision, and values, it is my job to feed that horse. Now, if other people walk past and make sure the water bucket is full, awesome. But I'm not asking everyone to do it. I know that it's my job to do it. And then we all get to then amplify. And I think it's the senior leader's job to lead that charge on the regular. And I do it with our staff team. I do it from the pulpit. I'm looking outside the door in my hallway. I have the five core commitments. We have them in big letters along the border of our hallway walls so that, and they are out in the congregational spaces because we just want them to be front and center. And then I get to talk about it all the time.
So good. Chris, last question. Thinking about where Trinity is at today, what's the next season about? What are you focused on? What do you feel like God is really putting front and center for you in this, in the days ahead?
That's a really inspiring question because it's what occupies most of my thinking these days. You know, I can say we feel called to plant churches and develop leaders. We believe that now is a time for us to turn into generative spaces. So to that end, we have a residency program. We have two church planters on our team now that have a 2-year process. They're 8 months in. We do fellows programs, which is more of a part-time way to bring young college graduates into discernment space. So we're very intentional about development. The language we use is we're going to conscientiously reject scarcity, meaning we're not going to be afraid to send people out with new church plants. We're not going to be afraid to get behind ideas with our money and our humans, because I just think that churches are healthier when they are open-handed and courageous about development. I've been watching the show on HBO, The Pit, the hospital show, you know, and it's a teaching hospital. And we want to be that kind of church. We want to be a church where senior leaders and junior leaders are working together so that the junior leaders one day become senior leaders. They get to go do their thing. And if we're not willing to be inconvenienced and have people tagging along and learning and growing, we'll never develop leaders in the church. And it's one of the reasons why I think we're missing out. So Trinity, me, I think we just felt like the next 25 years, if God gives us this church 25 more years, will be about leadership development. And I know for me personally, at 50 years old, really, I'm interested more in doing that with the back half of my career as a pastor, is developing leaders, doing the job, because that's what we have to do.
I love it. Chris, thanks for this. Such a great conversation. And love what you're doing at Trinity, what you've been doing over the last 25 years. Love what you're bringing to the diocese and to the broader church. Grateful for you, and just appreciate this really helpful conversation that I think is going to be so useful and relevant to so many people.
Really, really good to be with you.
Thanks, brother.
Thank you for listening to the C4SO podcast. If you found this episode useful, please be sure to subscribe and leave a review. That's how good conversations spread.